We're going to talk about Barack Obama. He's trying to make good on his promise to lead in a bipartisan manner. Yesterday, he was on Capitol Hill meeting with Republicans who are resisting his proposed $825 billion recovery plan. For those who know the president, even those who have very different views than his, it's no surprise he's reaching out. Bradford Berenson would be one of those people. They were classmates at Harvard Law School and worked together on the Harvard Law Review. Welcome and good morning, Bradford.
Good morning to you.
I should also add you worked in the Bush White House in the counsel's office from 2001 to 2003. So you're a Republican. Barack Obama is a Democrat. But yet and still, when you worked together, you had a few kumbaya moments?
Oh, I don't know if there was anything on the Harvard Law Review that really resembled a kumbaya moment. But we did work very productively together, as he did with many of the other conservatives and Republicans on the review at that time.
And you talk about how the president has a gift for negotiating. Explain.
Well, when conflicts would arise on the review, he usually set himself up as almost a mediator. And the pattern that we're seeing now in these early days of his presidency is somewhat surprisingly to me a familiar one. He would typically meet with each side of the dispute separately. Hear them out, let them have an opportunity to say their piece, explain their views. Typically in those meetings, he would indicate agreement in some way or another with some aspect or another of the point of view being expressed by one side and then the other side. He would then work a process to try to get people together to resolve their differences amongst themselves. And when they couldn't, he would obviously then step in and make the decision. Often it was kind of a Solomonic decision that gave each side a little something. But even in the instances where it wasn't, the process that he went through of genuinely listening and trying to understand where everybody was coming from made people feel like they had received a fair hearing, and it made his decisions easier to accept.
You talk about how his consistency has just been staggering. And when you say that, what do you mean?
Well, I would be the first one to say that one shouldn't too quickly draw any analogies between the presidency of the Harvard Law Review and the presidency of the United States. They're obviously
extremely different.
In every imaginable way. And I had a lot of doubt during the election whether the rather pragmatic and moderate Barack Obama that I worked with on the review in the early 90s would be the same man who ran a transition and began to govern as president. But I've been quite surprised by how familiar his conduct and behavior has been in that regard, and how much, so far at least, he really does seem to be genuinely at his core, despite an overall liberal philosophy, interested in working with the other side across the aisle and trying to achieve compromise and consensus in a practical way.
And you talk about how he's not one for petty small things. Tell us about that bagel incident when you guys were in law school.
Yeah, well, he was a few years older than the rest of us because of the experiences he'd had in Chicago before coming to law school. And so a little bit more mature. And back, you know, when in your early 20s, a few years can make a real difference. And he often reacted with some amusement to the heat and passion that the other editors brought to debates over really silly things, one of which was whether we ought to have fresh bagels available in Gannett House early in the morning. The editors would come in, they'd typically grab a bagel and go to class, and some people thought that when law review editors walked into a large lecture with a nice bagel, it seemed elitist, and so there was a big debate over that.
Well, he's got his priorities straight. Barack Obama certainly does. I guess what I'm wondering, Bradford, is if this is more than just a tactical, stylistic sense on the part of Barack Obama, if there may be some sort of philosophical underpinning that delivers the impulse to go immediately to the person you most disagree with, the person who's least like you. For instance, the interview with Al Arabiya as an opening gesture. Is this come from some sort of philosophical orientation?
I don't know whether there's a philosophy that underpins it, or whether it's mere tactics and sort of a smart way to co-opt or at least mute a lot of your opposition. But really the proof is going to be in the pudding, because certainly in Washington and on Capitol Hill, if you merely go through the motions of listening, but then the substance of what you do doesn't actually reflect an accommodation of the other side's priorities, you won't get away with this for very long. People will see it for what it is. So the real test is going to be whether the Republicans that he talks to on the Hill not only feel like he listens to and understands their concerns, but whether in some way or another he's willing to trim his policy sails to accommodate those concerns. And so far there are decent signs of that in the sense that he has insisted that the stimulus package include a significant tax cut component for lower-income Americans, which has been a priority for the Republicans as opposed to simply additional spending.
Well, it's going to be interesting days ahead for your former classmate, huh?
I think all of them will be, yes.
Bradford Berenson, we appreciate you joining us this morning.
It's my pleasure.
Bradford appeared in the PBS Frontline documentaries, The Choice and Dreams of Obama. Both were produced by our partners at WGBH Boston. You can watch him online at pbs.org.
And John Updike is dead at age 76, we've noted in this program, and he often worried that people no longer read books. But, you know, you can argue with John Updike. Was he right about that?
Hey, my name's Dave Seifert. I'm calling from Lockport, Illinois, and I just read Revolutionary Road by Richard Yates. I wasn't even aware it was a novel until I saw the promos for the movie, so I thought the book might be just about as interesting, and it was. It was a great read, and I can't wait to see the movie.
Lots of competition between media. Tell us the last book you read and why. Or if you don't read books, what do you read? Blogs, columns, or do you listen to podcasts instead? I'm currently reading John Updike's Due Considerations, Paula writes on our website, a collection of his essays and criticisms. One essay, a New York Times op-ed piece from June 2000, is titled A Case for Books. It's reassuring to read Updike's view, she says. Here's your takeaway.
Last year, the tone had actually already shifted, and most people here, to the extent they saved themselves, they sold their stock.
That's the most terrifying takeaway.
Yeah, it's not encouraging. No.
Andrew Ross Sorkin talking about last year's Davos Forum. He writes for the New York Times. What will the World Economic Forum participants do this year when they leave? Will they buy stock? Andrew, of course, is the chief mergers and acquisitions reporter and the editor of Deal Book, an online daily financial NewYorkTimes.com report. We are always on. If you missed anything, like Andrew Ross Sorkin's interview about the Davos World Economic Forum, take our podcast to go. Subscribe at thetakeaway.org or at iTunes.
I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. What's the last book you ever read? This is The Takeaway.